There was a lot of support out there for kids. There was some support out there for adults with ADD, and there was almost nothing out there to support parents of kids with ADHD and other issues, unless there was they were going to a support group. And there, you know, like Chad has support groups all over the country. If you happen to live in a city with a Chad support group and you happen to be available on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock to go wherever it was, then it was a great resource. But it wasn't available to a lot of people. And we live in a city like Atlanta where, you know, it could take you an hour and a half to get
to the group,
to said support group. So we realized that there was a real need for support for parents that wasn't being met. And we realized that we were really well suited to meet that need. We both had a background in national healthcare. And we started off, we were just going to do a workshop together. And the next thing we knew, we were an innovative program with Chad, and we had launched a global website that within a very short time was hit by like over 100 countries. And I mean, it just kind of blossomed fast, I think, because in those days there was so little support out there for parents.
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jessie LeBeau.
Well, here we are another week with some amazing teen experts. You guys, I am so excited to kind of jump into your story of how you guys came together and started this whole movement with everything that you're doing. So either one of you, feel free to take the reins here. I'm sure you've told this story once or twice before, but how did this all come to be with what you guys are doing?
Well, like, I don't know how much time we have to tell a whole story, but like, why don't I start it? Because it all started, I was doing some networking back in 2010. I was just starting as a coach. I wasn't sure really what I wanted to do as a coach. I wasn't sure, did I want to work with people with ADHD? Did I want to work with leaders? Like, what did I really want to do? And I was on a networking call with someone who lived in Massachusetts. And I was like, do you know anybody in the Atlanta area, which is where I happen to live, who does the kind of thing that you do? And they said, you got to meet Elaine Taylor Kloss and David Taylor Kloss, who's Elaine's husband as well, and they're both coaches. And so I networked in and started talking to Elaine, and we like tried to get together. We only live like 20 minutes apart, and still, like 14 years later, we rarely see each other because it's just like the way Atlanta's traffic works, I think. But we reached out and we decided, okay, let's connect at the International ADHD Conference in 2010. It was going to be in Atlanta. Well, it'll finally get a chance to kind of sit down and get to know each other and talk about what you're doing, what I'm doing, what do we want to do, that sort of thing. So do you want to jump in from there, Link?
Yeah, so we ended up spending the whole conference together. We had a blast, and we realized we were very like-minded in a lot of ways that we were looking at what was going on, and both of us had a very similar experience. We both had complex kids with ADHD plus other things, learning disabilities, etc. And both of us discovered that when we became coaches, we became better parents to our complex kids, and it wasn't rocket science. The other thing we saw very clearly in that conference was that there was a huge gap in services. There was a lot of support out there for kids. There was some support out there for adults with ADD, and there was almost nothing out there to support parents of kids with ADHD and other issues, unless they were going to a support group. And there, you know, like Chad has support groups all over the country. If you happen to live in a city with a Chad support group and you happen to be available on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock to go wherever it was, then it was a great resource. But it wasn't available to a lot of people. And we live in a city like Atlanta where, you know, it could take you an hour and a half to get
to the group,
to said support group. So we realized that there was a real need for support for parents that wasn't being met, and we realized that we were really well suited to meet that need. We both had a background in national healthcare, and we started off, we were just going to do a workshop together, and the next thing we knew, we were an innovative program with Chad, and we had launched a global website that within a very short time was hit by like over 100 countries. And I mean, it just kind of blossomed fast, I think, because in those days, there was so little support out there for parents.
Yeah.
In between the two of you, how many kids are we talking that you have been raising and figuring this out on your own before it turned into helping other people?
Well, my husband would answer that question by saying bodies or personalities.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, well, and it's grown, right? Because like when we started this, we each had three kids in our circle, her oldest, my oldest are now married, and we don't want to, you know, diagnose our in-laws and outlaws and things, but say we have 8 kids between the two families, and then one grandchild.
Yeah, and a couple of granddaughters.
I'm the only one with a grand. Yeah, and granddaughter.
And yeah, there's those families, and then just all of the other. I mean, part of what's happened is that we have grown to support parents literally all over the world. So there's our family and how that informs what we do. But then there's the stories and the experiences of all the thousands and thousands of people we've had the joy and benefit of working with all over the years.
Well, and I think that that's one of the things that is so important when you're a parent is, and I'm going to tell you, you know, I can imagine the listeners in your audience, Jesse, it's like this sort of, I've been to so many therapists, I've been to so many experts, I've been to so many of these different places, and they're so well-meaning. I remember one of the first therapists I went to, like young kid, really well-meaning, had no kids, right? Had no sense of what it was like. And parents say this all the time. My therapist suggested that I do X, or the book suggested I do X. And where I think coaching tools help is this sort of, how do I figure out how to make it work for me and my own family system, instead of just kind of taking a generic piece of advice and trying to do what is being told to me. I don't know how else to say that. Elaine, did that make sense?
Yeah, I think it makes great sense. I mean, what you're not saying, and what I guess would help to explain, is the foundation of what we do that I think differentiates us from a lot of the support out there is we actually teach neurodiversity-informed coaching skills to parents. So it's not just information out there of, you know, here's a reward chart, but we actually teach parents enough skills and tools and concepts from the world of coaching for them to take what we call a coach approach with their kids. We don't want them to train them to become their kid's coach. We want you to be your kid's parent. But when you begin to use tools from the world of coaching is a very empowerment-based modality. And so you are empowering these kids, fostering their independence, kids of any age, and really learning how to communicate with them in a way that diffuses their defensiveness and engages them in the process of taking ownership of their life, which is what we really want for them. But it doesn't really work when you're telling them to do it. It works really well when you stand alongside them and collaborate with them in learning how to take ownership of their life.
Well, and Elaine, you said neurodiversity informed, and I'm going to expound on that and say, because I know not everybody listening has what they would call it a neurodiverse kid, but I'm going to say two things. One is that coaching tools work regardless of whether your kid is neurodiverse or neurotypical. And if you've got a teenager, chances are there are moments when they appear to be neurodiverse, whether they're overwhelmed or shut down or angry or frustrated. Any of us, when we're overcome by emotion, fear, worry, those sorts of things, we go into a state where we really don't have access. When I say neurodivergent, it's like we don't have access to, you know, the part of our brain that helps us to self-manage and get stuff done because we're overwhelmed and shut down. It's technically no different than if you happen to be officially diagnosed with something that causes that on an ongoing basis.
Yeah.
We call that the red zone, the psychological red zone. Yes. If you're 7 or 10 higher, and it's like everything's out the window when you're in that zone, not just for kids, but for parents too, a lot of times.
That's right. Well, have you noticed, I'm curious, Jesse, because parents come to us all the time and say, they're going from 0 to 100 or 0 to 10. And like, no, they're not actually going from 0 to 10 because they're walking around at a constant 7.
Yeah, their baseline is very elevated.
That's
yeah,
right.
100%. Yeah. I'm curious, can we just reverse it a little bit here and back it up? What exactly is a complex kid for those who don't know what that is?
So I define a complex kid as a kid who struggles with any aspect of life, learning, behavior, academic, or social challenges. And so probably all kids at some point are going to be complex at some point, or you might say every kid, as we live in complex times, is going to have areas of life that they struggle with sometimes. So when a kid is not hitting the metric or hitting the expectations like their peers are in any area of their development, then that's a complex issue for the family to navigate. And that's something that parents very often need help navigating from a lens that's positive and empowering, instead of trying to say, well, what's broken that needs to be fixed? Because what's consistent among kids, especially teenagers, is that they're going to be inconsistent. Yeah. Right?
Consistently
inconsistent. Well, and what I would add is that, a lot of the parents in our community have kids who do carry with them an official diagnosis. Many of them do not, but the ones we diagnose, the ones that we most commonly see, might be ADHD, they might be anxiety, they might be autism, they might be learning issues.
Depression.
And not everyone in our community that has a complex kid. We always say, if you have a complex kid, you know it. But not everybody in our community has an official diagnosis or anything like that.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And now the next question, kind of follow up to that, is what is a neurodivergent kid? Is that a same thing, but a different term for it? Or how would you break down the difference between those two things, if there is one?
So it's so interesting. There's been a lot of research done in the last 10 years on what they call the neuroscience of coaching. And all of that research is done on what they call neurotypical people. Those are brains that tend to function in a certain way based on, like everybody else. People who are neurodiverse or neurodivergent, what neurodiversity means, everybody's brain is different. Bottom line, everybody's brain is different. We all function, we do and act and be how we be based on how our brain is wired. And for people who have neurodiversity or neurodivergence, or we like to call them neurospicy people, their brains may be wired a little bit differently. So they may, like a kid with ADHD, may be wildly creative and, expert in some area, right? We often say that these kids are specialists in a generalized world. So you've got a Michael Phelps who could like hyper-focus and this extraordinary swimmer, but he struggled with other areas of executive function of organizing himself and navigating. But the swimming was kind of the balance for him. So when we talk about people with neurospiciness or neurodivergence, their brains may be wired to function differently and they may struggle with what the world expects of them as a result of that. What would you add, Di?
No, I think that that's true. I think that that goes back to your kids who struggle with life learning behavior, right? It's a sort of, and it's often because, as a society, we talked about this on our podcast recently, that our school system, as an example, was created back in the 1930s when it was really designed to create factory workers, right? It's a sort of, it's evolved since then, but a lot of what we do is to try to create little tiny machines, right? And have everybody fit in together. And if you're noticing that your kid's having a hard time and fitting into that mold, that may be a great indication that they are neurospicy.
I used to say to my son that what I love about him most is that he didn't let school get in the way of his education.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? I love that. So you guys came together and started Impact ADHD. What was the mission and kind of driving force behind that? And I know it's evolved since then, but tell me a little bit about that resource that you created for parents.
So Impact ADHD, what we found early on was ADHD was kind of the common link that the two of us could land on. And it was a clear audience that needed to be served was those parents. And we knew that coaching was an incredible way to improve the dynamic in your relationship with your kids and to get, you know, help your kids achieve their potential. And so we wanted to come together and bring this coach approach to parents. And ADHD was the first audience because it was the clearest audience. And then what became very clear to us very quickly was that ADHD travels with a lot of cousins. And it's very uncommon, actually, for a kid to be diagnosed with just ADHD and not have some of these other issues. The correlation with learning disabilities is extremely high, anxiety extremely high, higher propensity for depression, higher propensity, there's some overlap with autism. So So what became very clear, and the reason we expanded, was because ADHD, we wanted to make sure parents dealing with complex kids could find themselves, and that they weren't saying, well, no, that's not for me because my kid's not been diagnosed with ADHD. When the truth is that it's not about the diagnosis, it's about understanding that some kids travel through the world with a different way of being and a different brain wiring. And as parents, when we learn to understand that and meet them where they are, we can really empower them to reach their full and greatest potential.
Well, and at the core of it, at the core of it, Jesse, we've been kind of really providing three core things: parent training, which is recommended treatment if you happen to have a child who has ADHD
or
other executive function challenges. Coaching, which we talked about earlier, is really about how do we begin to take all the information we're learning and put it into practice, and then support, because it's really isolating
and
community, right? It's just sort of, if you have a kid with ADHD or you have a kid who's struggling, a lot of parents will say, nobody else gets it. Like parents, what my neighbors say, you just got to be tougher on your kid, or you just got to set boundaries, or you have to, you know, discipline, or and those sorts of things just don't work the same way if you have a complex kid. And so connecting parents to other parents who are going through some of the same challenges is a third key part of what we do at Impact Parents.
Got it. So if a parent has a teenager who's a teen boy and he's having a hard time in school focusing, and it feels like he could be on the borderline of ADHD, how do you determine if this is just a teen boy that has energy and isn't interested in the things that are being taught in school, and someone that has full-blown ADHD and needs other help and attention?
Well, so here's what I would say. We wouldn't make that determination. That's not our work. We work with parents. We would refer that parent to some different resources potentially for them to have an evaluation if they felt like that was important and something they were looking for. But we do not do diagnosis. And again, on some level, there's a way in which it doesn't matter to us what the kid is diagnosed, because we're not actually as focused on the child as we are on the parent. Parenting is actually about parents. And so we tend to say that if a parent can understand what they're dealing with and what they're bringing to the dynamic, and they can't, yet there's definitely a piece that's about evaluating what's going on with the kid, because if a kid's struggling, we want to make sure we understand why they're struggling so we can support them in that, right? So we are we're big proponents of diagnosis if appropriate, but we don't do diagnosis. But whether there is a diagnosis or not, you know, Diane would say, act as if, right? If you start by assuming that the kid's struggling with something, an underlying neurological difference, and you accommodate for that and you see improvement, that gives you some indication that there may be something there that you could be working with. If you start by assuming they're doing it because they're disrespectful or they don't care, and you don't get results from that, that's another indication that there could be something underlying.
Well, and I was actually going to take it that direction, right? Because you ask, is this regular teen behavior or is this something else going on? And that's actually, that perspective shift is one that we teach all the time. The language we use is it naughty or is it neurological? And the goal of that inquiry is not to understand 100% whether this is naughty or 100% whether this is neurological, but take your teen boy who's resisting and maybe being rude or pushing
or leaving
back,
their towel on the floor, or not doing their homework,
whatever the behavior is. And if I gotta go, okay, you're being rude and you're being disrespectful. If I see this kid as being rude, I might put my hands on my hip and say, how dare you? You can't treat me like that. I'm your parent. You need to listen to me. And chances are all of you have tried that and you've gotten whatever results you get from that experiment. But if you go, wait a second, maybe my kid is having a really hard time being respectful right now. What might be going underneath it? Like, it might be just stress. It might be overwhelm. It might be frustration or fear or, you know,
embarrassment or shame.
Like all those sorts of things that might be going on underneath it. But if I say this is a kid who's in a shame cycle, how do I help him to move out of it versus this kid's being rude? I'm going to approach it completely differently.
Yeah, that's huge, right? All you can control a lot of times is your reaction and the example that you're setting. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you guys see parents making today that you're able to help them with?
Oh, that's a big question. I think probably the biggest, I don't want to use the word mistake, okay? Because I think parents are doing the best they can.
Yeah.
I think that we struggle because a lot of us are still trying to parent in an old paradigm that doesn't really work in today's world. So, you know, we parent from our own stories and our own life experiences and what we, either we want to do what we thought was done well, or we don't want to do what we thought was done poorly and we overreact or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's hard not to parent your kids based on the world you grew up in.
Yeah.
And our kids are growing up in a world that's kind of still a little unfathomable to us, right? They are connected and exposed to a larger global world in a very profound way from a very, very young age. Mm-hmm. And so we cannot parent them based on how it was done with us, because that's not the world we're raising them in. So I think that's the biggest thing that I think parents miss, is the reason we need help and support and training and all of this is because the world is significantly different than our kind of foundational understanding of parenting.
Well, I think the other thing that I would say, and again, I like that, Elaine, I don't like to use the word mistake, but I think the other place that parents get tripped up is that they focus on the thing that's going on right now. They focus, you were talking about the kid who doesn't hang up his towel, the kid who's not getting off the computer and is playing video games at 2 a.m, the kid who's not turning in his homework, right?
The kid who's not brushing his teeth.
Not brushing his teeth. Whatever that thing is we focus on that. Instead of saying, like, let's go to the kid who's not turning in his homework, if we understand that what's really going on is the kid is having a hard time remembering the things that he needs to do because he's overwhelmed or he's distracted or whatever it is, the underneath piece of it, in the long run, I want a kid who's going to remember whatever it has to be when things are stressful, right? It's a sort of, he or she is under a stressful situation in a job and they need to be able to remember, what are the to-dos for my boss? Or I'm trying to be a good partner and I'm trying to remember to stop at the store on the way home. I mean, those are the life skills we're ultimately trying to teach. And if we're just focusing on hang up the freaking towel instead of going, what's really going on here that's making it hard for my child to remember the thing that they know that they wanted, they're supposed to do, then I can teach the life skill, or I can inspire the life skill. I don't want to say teach, because a lot of times as parents, it's not our job to teach the life skill, but it might be our job to inspire the life skill.
Well, and the other thing that happens building on that is that we have this tendency, we set expectations. We don't always get our kids buy-in. We expect it of them, and we expect them to want to do it because we expect it of them. And so there's also a piece about, and then we get frustrated if they don't get the help that we think they need, and we decide they need, and they're not taking the help. And so there's another piece about parenting in the modern world that is about what we call collaborative parenting, but it's really about getting alongside and supporting our kids in achieving what's important to them. And so maybe that's inspiring, as Diane said, and enrolling them into a sense of ownership of whatever it is. But if we are standing on the outside kind of pointing our finger, or expecting hands on hips, as you were saying, you're going to get a very different response from your kids, because especially teenagers, right? Teenagers are separate, independent beings. They are individuating developmentally appropriately. They are supposed to be separating from you. And if we try to parent a 14-year-old like we would an 8-year-old, we're going to get pushback because they're not 8. They're 14 and they're starting to look for independence and separation and autonomy. So as parents, we have to shift how we're communicating with them so that we can recognize that they are separate, independent, young adults, but still growing, emerging into adulthood, and begin to involve them in the process of making decisions for themselves, instead of just making decisions for them and then being angry and disappointed when they're not doing what we think they should be doing. the truth is, as Diane was saying, is we want to set them up to be able to be their own decision makers. And we want them to practice it while they're still in our home. So they get better at it so that when they actually leave, they've got some experience learning how to go through the process of problem solving and decision making for themselves. That's our job. But we don't always see it that way because we focus on what we want from them more than what we want for them.
Well, and that doesn't mean that as parents, we, you know, suddenly our kids are our peers and we're going to have a collaborative decision making. I mean, it's like that parents get really worried that they're going to lose their power if they collaborate. And I think that that's an important caveat here, is that there is absolutely a time and a place to have a rule or an agreement or a whatever, a boundary that you put in place that protects your child and protects your safety and everything else. And let's pay attention to the long game and not just stand there with our hands on our hips. Going back to what you said earlier, Lane, in the old model of parenting, because the old model of parenting often doesn't work with today's teens.
Well, and one more thing I want to add to that is one of the things we teach a lot is to make the distinction between task and relationship. And I think what happens with parents of teenagers a lot is that we get so focused on the tasks. We're starting to worry that the clock is ticking. We're starting to worry we only have 3 more years before they leave. We're starting, like, whatever it is, they're not going to be able to fill in the blank. So we get really fixated on the task, and we actually let go of that relationship, the connection that has them trust us. When they're kids, we're connected, we're loving on them, they trust us, and we fall out of trust of them. They fall out of trust with us and with themselves. And without that trust, the relationship, it makes it a lot harder to help them, to work with them, to achieve what is possible for them, because it becomes this pushback resistance game. And so we really want to emphasize the role that relationship plays, because the tasks will get done better if you're in relationship than if you're so focused on the task that you're actually sacrificing.
Well, and that's hard to do because our world is moving so fast and there are so many things to get done and it feels like they'll never get done. And so many of us as parents are trying to do our own stuff. And if you're trying to help your kid do their stuff, it just feels like, and if you've got more than one kid, I mean, it feels like it's going to be exhausting. And
somehow it's easier.
I think I can make this promise that if you can find some space to take a step back and go, wait a second, how am I doing on my relationship with this kid? It's going to make the doing the stuff so much easier.
Can I give an example?
Yeah. I'd love it.
So I'm laughing and I'm listening as I'm listening to this, because I was just talking to a client of mine, a couple that I work with the other day. When my son was about 16 or 17, he was going away to a sleepaway camp leadership program kind of thing with his youth group, right? And he was at the stage where he no longer wanted me to be going through with him and saying, here's the checklist of things that you need to bring with you to camp. And he was like, I got this, Mom. I got this, right? And I was like, great, you got this. That's fine. So fortunately, it was a camp that had where he was able to keep his phone. Because the first night there, I get a text. Hey, Mom, I forgot to pack sheets.
Kind of a big one.
And then the text thread went on and on and on. It's like, well, there's no pillow, there's no blanket, it's cold up there, etc. And instead of rushing to fix it and FedExing a package to him, or going to, well, see, I told you you needed to listen to me and go through the list, I just said, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? And we navigated this whole dynamic on a text thread where he was like, I'm borrowing this from this person and this from this person. And when all was done, I was like, okay, well, if I express it, it's going to cost you $130. If I just do it general mail, it's going to cost you $35. Which do you want me to do? He's like, the $35 is fine. I can handle it. I'm like, okay, that's great. And I captured this whole text thread because it was a perfect example of, I didn't rescue him. I let him do it his way. He learned a lot from it, but he didn't learn it from me preaching at him. And I was able to be on his team, his supporter, saying, okay, what do you need? I'm happy to help you through this. How can I help? But I wasn't rescuing him from the mistake. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's so critical. We talk about that all the time, is they've got to fail within reason and safety and all those concerns and things, but they've got to learn that's a part of life, is you're going to make mistakes and it's not the end of the world. You can bounce back. You can be resourceful. You can get a sleeping bag so you don't even need sheets or a pillow. It's all kind of built in this one thing here like we did in the olden days.
Right.
And you can be set up and maybe save $135 or $35.
And P.S., he became the best packer in the family.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Right?
One time without cheats and you'll be like, I'm going to have this checklist on my phone each time and become OCD now.
Well, and I think it's a great example. And I want to just highlight that if you've got a complex kid, just because they've had a failure does not necessarily mean that they can just learn from their mistakes, right? It's just a lot of times parents will be like, okay, I'll let them experience failure and then they'll learn. And then they're frustrated because the same thing continues to happen and over and over and over again. Well, that's a great indication that this kid doesn't have the executive function to learn from that mistake and might need your help to learn from the mistake.
I was going to say, and one of the tools we teach, we call it the magic three questions, right? Is the opportunity after that experience to say, okay, well, what part of you packing this summer worked? What didn't work? What do you want to do differently? So that he had his own insights and learning to inform how he was going to do it in the future. And it informed Mike, how do you want me to support you next time? Well, maybe you can ask me this. So he was in the lead, but I didn't just say, okay, you're on your own next time. I stayed in the conversation with him around what he was learning and the insights he was getting from it so he could do it differently. But again, without doing it with a wagging finger, which is the key.
Yeah, yeah, we're in this journey and we're learning together through this experience that just happened. Right. And I really like that taking ownership and responsibility for their own lives and getting empowered to start making those decisions. Yeah. One of the phrases that we say a lot is we're preparing your teen for the road ahead, and we're not running ahead and clearing out the road so that they can now handle adversity. They can handle, you know, these difficult speed bumps that come along the way and have some grit and have some resilience in these different things.
Yeah. You know, in college campuses, they're calling them snowplow parents now.
Yeah. 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 Right? Yeah. I heard that one too. There's a few different names, helicopter, snowplow, all of them. Yeah. Either way, it's kind of saying the same thing of, hey, your kid needs to build some resilience and they're only going to do that through getting out of their comfort zone. And that's one thing I want to talk about here in a second, is how technology has changed so much of this, like we've talked about earlier in this, and being connected, and it's just a totally different world than we're experiencing. But before I go there, I wanted to ask you guys, I do a lot of things with parents, a lot of conversations, a lot of talks, and a lot of times I really feel like the kids have outsmarted the parents and are in control. And some of the things that they used are these diagnoses. So, well, I'm ADHD, I'm autistic, I'm anxious, my mental health, and I shouldn't have to go to school today, and you can't tell me what to do because I might, you know, do something that we're all gonna regret. And they weaponize these things. I mean, there is even a thing, if you're being a little brat, you can say, oh, well, I have oppositional defiant disorder for just being a brat, right? So there's literally something for everything. And in my personal opinion, it's way over diagnosed. I know you guys would probably debate me on that, but we're not going to go into that. And I like that your answer earlier is, well, whether they are or aren't, here are the tools that can help them. So do you guys see this in your work with parents as well, that sometimes it's like the kids, let me give you an example. I'm a parent, I have an 18-year-old, he plays video games, sleeps in, he graduated from high school, and he smokes weed, lives in my house, never paid a dollar for rent, never had a job, but doesn't want to go to college or university now, and doesn't know what they want to do in their life, but is living in our house rent-free, doing these things that I don't approve with as a parent. And I don't know what to do. What would you say to a parent like this? These are ones I hear every week.
Yeah, so do we. Diane, do you want to start or you want me to?
Well, I think that the place to start is that it's almost like a reengineering, right? We were talking about relationship and at the bottom of our model for independence is relationship, trust, and communication, right? And so yes, you want to help your child to launch and to do things and to move forward. And I think that I was just talking to a parent this morning, and they were stuck between, do I just sit and wait till my kid figures it out? Or do I try the tough love approach, right? It's just sort of, and what we're looking for is the space in between, because tough love or just sit back and secretly pray that eventually they launch, in between that, there's a lot of room. And you've got to be in relationship with your child to even explore getting into that conversation to figure it out. And I can tell you that these kids don't really want to be at home playing video games for the rest of their lives. They don't. They may even say that they do and that they don't care, but absolutely they don't want to be. And making decisions and being an adult and taking action is harder than we think it is. Somebody said to me today, and it was a really great paradigm shift. If you've got let's say that you become an adult at 18, and so you're 20, right? You're no longer a teenager, but like let's say you're 20, you're actually only a 2-year-old adult.
Yeah.
And here I am. I'm a 40 something year old adult, because I'm in my 60s, right? And so I'm comparing my ability to adult to someone who's only been adulting or even beginning to try to adult for a little while, right? And so, and adulting is hard. So it's about helping our kids maneuver through the skills of adulthood rather than just expecting, okay, wait a second, you're 18, now it's time for you to stop being a kid and start doing grown-up stuff.
Which is what they're terrified about.
Yes. Right? Yes.
So a couple of things that come up. First, I want to go back to the first part of what you were saying, which is weaponizing, right? And I would say that sometimes kids weaponize it, sometimes parents weaponize it. Mm. And what's really important is that a diagnosis is an explanation. It's not an excuse for bad behavior.
Mm.
It's an explanation for what's making a particular skill or behavior challenging. And we can do something, we can help with that. But the notion of somebody saying, well, I have ODD, so I can't do this. Well, in fact, if you have ODD, that means your ADD isn't well managed. And so let's get on managing the ADD so you can stop being so oppositional, because that's got to be a lousy way to go through the world. That can't feel good for you. It certainly doesn't feel good for those of us around you. Let's work with that. Let's do something about it.
But it's fun to watch Larry David live that lifestyle.
Right?
And everything, but it's not fun to actually live it in your own life.
It's not. And it's not. And this, to Diane's point, it's not fun for them either. This is not what they want for themselves. Very often what happens when they're teens is they're so terrified of what they think is expected of them when they become adults that they resist adulting because it's so intimidating. I remember one of my kids, and this kid is now 27 and in medical school. So she's so far so great, right? Making it. But when she was 17, she was hesitant to apply to college because she was sure that by the time she turned 18, she had made up in her mind that she had to be able to know how to do her own taxes. Mm-hmm. That's what adulting was in her mind. And so part of it is demystifying for them what is the expectation. And I love the paradigm you're talking about, Diane, about this is your first year of adulting. What do you have to do in your first year? What do you do in your second year? So that, and again, we go back to, it's not that you don't have agreements and arrangements and all of that, but that we do it collaboratively. If you've got a kid who's 18 at home, your scenario, smoking weed and not working anything else, that's a great time to work with the kid if you improve the communication skills, to be able to work with the kid to say, so what do you want? What's the next level of independence you want? You know, are you ready? What do you think it's reasonable to expect for you to pay for yourself first? Your phone? Do you want to pay rent? Do you want to, I don't know what it is. It doesn't matter really what it is you navigate, but that you're constantly incrementally guiding them to take aim on the next level of independence and the next level of independence. Ideally something they want that they can see what's in it for them, because the success breeds success. If you get them through the one thing and they start feeling good about, okay, I got that, they're more inclined to move forward. And we see this happen in our coaching groups all the time, because we have coaching groups for parents of teens and then for parents of young adults and younger as well, of course. But and you really do see the progress over time, but it's not as visible in a month as it is, you know, in 3 months or 6 months.
Yeah.
But the kids taking ownership and feeling like the parents are on their team, working with them instead of expecting of them, it shifts everything.
Yeah. The taking 100% responsibility is so huge. And that's something that I've really come to a strong stance on in conclusion, is because I'll work with parents, families, in the teens themselves. And a lot of times mom and dad want these big changes and these transformations and these big goals for them with scholarships and that kind of thing. But I believe every person has to want it for themselves. Just what you're saying, take responsibility. And as much as the parents want it and their heart is in the right place, and as much as you and me, coaches, can want it for them, they have to want it for themselves. And if they don't, you know, unfortunately, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So do you guys have any tips or insights of how you can get your kid to want these changes for themselves that will improve their lives, whether it's dealing with anything that's complex or anything that they're dreaming of going towards as a goal or struggling with in their life? How do you get the horse to want to drink the water, in your guys' opinion?
Well, I want to clarify what you're saying, because there's actually a space between drinking the water and wanting to drink the water that we miss, because we're very action oriented as a society, right? It's this sort of, we're like, okay, so if they wanted a job, they'd be out there applying for a job. And there's actually a couple of steps in between, like, I secretly want to get a job, but I'm terrified and I'm afraid I'm going to fail and I'm kind of stuck. Or I tried to do something before and you were all judgy, mom or dad, and I'm afraid to take action because I'm afraid you're going to tell me I'm doing it wrong. Or, you know, there's that part of it. And then there's this sort of, okay, I want to do this and I can imagine doing it. And I own that. But I'm kind of just dreaming about what would it be like and how would I do it? And then there's this sort of, okay, how would I do it? Right. And it's this sort of, so many times as parents, we skip over that part. I have a kid who's in the middle of a job application process, and she's been there for 6 months, and she's learning mightily what it takes to get a job, right? And she's realizing that the way she tried it 6 months ago is very different than what she's doing now, but she had to go through this process and figure out, oh, wait, it didn't work the way I thought it would. Mom was right. I shouldn't say that, but mom was right. And
I got to make a resume or whatever.
Now I'm doing the networking. Now I'm having the conversations. Now I'm doing the, you know, but, and it was really her kind of getting through, what is this going to take? And maybe bumping up against a few things of what she thought it would take and then it wouldn't take. And that's still very action oriented. There's all that stuff that happens in between, right?
Yeah. My mom used to say, stumbling forward. You know, even if you don't quite get the job and you don't exactly, you learn, oh, I have to get a reference in a resume and I got to show up on time and I need to shake someone's hand and look them in the eye and fake it if I don't totally know it and give my best effort. And that's okay. Elaine, I saw you scribbling down there. I feel like you had something awesome to add.
Yeah, and I love stumbling forward. I usually say spiraling forward, but I like
that. Okay, yeah.
There are two things that come up for me from your question, okay? What can parents do is what I heard you say.
Yes, to help get their kid to want it for themselves.
And there are two things that come up. One is, I really believe, is getting better educated about how your kid, what makes them tick, what makes them work. In our lens, I would say understand diversity, neurodiversity, like understand how your kid's brain works. And you think you do, but when you begin to understand neurodiversity and neurodivergence, you begin to see different ways to interact with your kids based on how they process information, based on their learning styles, based on whether they're introvert or extrovert, et cetera. So one is slow down, back up, and get to know your kid from a different lens. Really understand. I often say our job as parents is to be on our journey, and our journey is to support them on their journey. It's to understand them well enough to help them learn to understand themselves well enough to learn to want to manage themselves. That's the game. So step one, I think, is to step back and now that they're young adults, look at them differently, understand differently, get the support training you need to do that. The other thing I would say, and I think that this is something that I've been saying from the beginning, and I just think is one of the most important things we can share with parents. And there's a ton of research on this. There's the research on the resilience, the research on hope, there's all the research in positive psychology. Your kids need you to believe in them, especially when they're struggling to believe in themselves. Mm-hmm. When they feel your fear, what if they can't? What if he doesn't? What if she can't? Like that, they're going to absorb that. And when they feel you saying, I get that you're struggling with this, and I know you're not sure you can do it, but I know you're going to get there. I see what you're capable of. I'm going to hold that for you till you're able to believe it for yourself. That is what they, because teenagers are predisposed to question and doubt and not be sure about themselves, and then to be overly confident and indispensable, or whatever the word is, can't be beaten, right? And then they go back to, I'm not so sure, and self-doubt. And so our job is to hold a steady belief in their capacity, no matter where they are on that trajectory, so that they always know where that North Star, where they can look to us to go, oh yeah, this is what she sees for me. This is what they know is possible for me. I may not see it yet, but they see it, and I'm going to lean into that.
Well, and everything you just said, Elaine, and that requires as parents that we do our own work, right? It's just sort of, if I am catastrophizing and terrified that my kids is going to still be in my basement when they're 34 years old playing video games 24
hours
a day,
that.
It's going to be really hard for me to believe in my kids' future, right? And so that means I've got to work on myself and my stories and my fears and my stuff so that I can be there for my kid, right? And it's sometimes as simple as, Elaine, we always use this phrase, this kid needs a win, right? And it may have nothing to do with the job search or the everything else, but maybe you just notice where your kid is winning. I happen to have a gamer kid, and we spend a lot of time talking about what's he playing and what does he love about it and what level is he at and how quickly did he get through the, I mean, it's like this sort of paying attention to what makes your kid feel like they can accomplish stuff is one of the best things you can do to help your kids realize that they can accomplish stuff.
And
I love it.
And I go back to, at the end of the day, we have to hold a vision for them, because very often they struggle to hold it for themselves. And when we work on the relationship and we build the trust, they are able to trust our vision for them even when they're not yet quite ready to trust their own.
I think that's just great leadership. Right. Great leadership and great parenting, which, as a parent, you are the leader, and they're just sponges and they're so malleable. Yeah. And so getting it to, that you're actually walking the walk, and that self-work that you said, Diane, it's so, so important. They're absorbing everything, whether you realize it or not. And that's a tough one, because you got to look in the mirror for that a lot of times. Yeah. I know we're running out of time here, but there is one thing I want to ask you guys, because you mentioned earlier the difference of the world today versus 10 years ago, 20 years ago, the time that you guys have been doing this work and raising kids and putting them out in the world left and right. I want to know, technology, a complex kid, what is the impact that you've seen, the smartphone, social media, and some good things, some bad things? What do you advise parents when it comes to dealing with, like you said, whether it's video games or anything else technologically related?
It's such a big question.
It's a huge question. Here, we've done a lot of work on this over the years, as you can imagine. And, there's a lot more happening now. We're seeing more and more people, more and more young people saying, it's enough, and removing themselves. My son said to me a few months ago, he's 23, he said, Mom, there is not a kid my age who hasn't been traumatized by the internet. And that's a powerful statement from a 23-year-old, right?
Yeah.
So I think that we want to shift from the tendency to demonize technology and to make it wrong or bad, and to shift to enrolling, inviting, guiding, teaching, helping our kids figure out how they want to be in relationship with technology. And we can't do that if we're demonizing it. My kid, my young adult, can choose a vacation. What do you call it? A detox vacation.
A detox,
right?
Vacation, yeah.
Digital detox.
It's their choice. But if I'm forcing it, then they get to blame me for it and not be recognizing the benefit that they get from it. And so we really want to shift the conversation from, is technology good or bad? Or is technology bad, which is our parental tendency, right, for a lot of us, and move into a conversation about how do you want to be with this? How do you want to learn to be in relationship with technology? How does it support you? How does it not? Because there's some amazing opportunities it can afford us if we choose to interact with it rather than letting it dominate us. But in our community, it can take over if we're not careful.
Yeah.
Well, and what I would add is let's go back a few years, because you're talking about your young adult. Let's go back, and those of you who have younger teens, what I would reiterate is that what you're really trying to do is establish long-term healthy relationships with technology.
Yeah.
And I think about a client I have. She's got a 13-year-old son, and she's been taking a digital detox periodically in front of her child because she knows as a neurodivergent adult that it's healthy for her to be like, I just need to unplug. And about 3 weeks ago, he said, Mom, I really think I need to take a digital detox at 13, right?
Yeah.
You want to help them realize I'm struggling, not controlled. I mean, and that's this is long-term game. We're going to live with computers, right? I have a computer like that's basically attached to me because I walk around with it in my pocket all day. Lord knows what it's going to be like 10 years from now when these kids, like it may be even more connected than it is right now. And it's an amazing, amazing gift, right? There's so many things you can do with it. And it's about creating a healthy relationship. And so it's about noticing what is healthy, what isn't healthy. I mean, that's really ultimately what we're trying to do, is to help our kids develop habits. Because I got to tell you, when your kid goes off to college, you're not going to be there to turn off the internet at midnight.
No.
Yes.
So they've got to figure out how to turn it off on their own, or when to turn it off, or how to navigate when they forget to turn it off and they're up and trying to get to class at 8 a.m. Right. or whatever it happens to be, right?
And that's where the relationship with it comes in. I mean, I remember one of my kids coming to me at 14 or 16, I think, and saying, I am having a hard time studying for exams. Can you change my password to whatever the social media is, and then we can change it back after exams?
That is huge. That's such a win. Talk about a win.
I can't say that kid.
Because nobody has the self-control to resist it, in my opinion. I haven't met
it's
a person.
So hard.
Myself
I've deleted Facebook from my computer, from my phone, at least four times in the last year. And then I put them back on again. But then it's like, can I try it? I'm like, can I do it again? And I'm like, no, I better take it off. You know, we're all figuring it out, right?
We're all figuring it out. And if we can be in that place of, well, we're figuring it out, let's be in an experimenter's mind, how can we support you in this, instead of, you've got to put that thing away, like, you're going to have a whole different relationship. Or if you can get curious about, what are you watching? You seem like you're having such a good time, so that you're sharing it.
Yes, an experience with other people, like going to a movie theater and you're watching this with other people, or instead of just scrolling and browsing by yourself.
Exactly.
Well, and you can model that. Send your kid a crazy cat meme at least once a day. That's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meme? Maybe not cat.
Not a cat meme, but something silly.
Something fun. Something fun. Well, you guys, I appreciate you making the time for this and the impact that you're having in the world. I know we need to wrap up, but before we do, I have one final thing for each of you. I need your 30-second best piece of advice. If you were to go back in time and give yourself one piece of parenting advice when you were just starting your parenting journey.
Wow.
Elaine, I'm letting you go first. 30 seconds.
One piece of parenting advice. Put the stick down. Just like, we all have this kind of well-worn groove in our head from hitting ourselves over the head to get it right, do it this way, do it. Just put the stick down and focus more on the being, who you're being as a parent, than what you're doing. And really take the energy and the time to to be in relationship with your kid, because that will set the stage for everything else. It's really, parenting is about who you're being, not what you're doing.
Whew, tough act to follow.
Well, I was just going to say, we're both so coachy, because I was going to probably say something that's similar, right? I think that the taking the being and the doing to a step beyond that, right? It's just sort of to not get so hung up in the stuff, right? Yeah. It's just sort of, it's really easy to be like the grades and the finals and the this and the that, and the, like, you get so stuck in the stuff of life. And I'm a check it off and get it done type A human. I mean, that's how I show up in the world. And she's not, but I am, right? And if I had remembered, okay, wait, some of this stuff is not as important as you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
And really, that would be the piece of advice, is to go, like, what's the thing? It's like 3 minutes from now, 3 years from now, sort of thing, thinking forward, what's going to be important about this? And to be gentle with yourself, right? Because I can say this all day long, is to balance the relationship with this, getting the stuff done. And I know that I'm a get it stuff done human. And so if I'm picking up the stick going, you're supposed to be spending time with your kids and you're being so worried about XYZ, that's not going to help either. So
no, you got to put that stick down. Whatever that stick is, down, you put it up, down.
You're grabbing it out. The stick's everywhere.
I have parents that I tell to go outside, get a stick and bring it inside and put it on the desk or the kitchen counter.
It's a reminder.
To remember not to.
Remind you. And then my favorite was somebody who brought it back to me the next week and said, I have painted it and it is now my magic wand.
Aw. I love it. Another type A, it sounds like.
Probably.
Where can our parents go to find out more about what you guys are doing? Is it the podcast? Where would you send them?
So I think you're listening to us on your podcast. Our podcast is called Parenting with Impact. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on wherever you happen to be listening to your podcast. I think, Jesse, in the show notes, you're going to also put a link to a free gift that we have for your audience. If they're interested in getting on our newsletter, on our mailing list, they can click on that link there and go to impactparents.com/podcast or whatever the link happens to be that we're giving
you. Well, and you'll be able
to
download something for free, because there's lots of really good, you know, parent guides and stuff for free on the website.
Amazing.
There's a lot available. But,
yay.
But the biggest thing I would say is, here, there, wherever you are, get connected, get support, get help. Don't do this alone.
Get a community. It's so big. I believe it's in our DNA. That's how we were hardwired to be. And that's why we're having a lot of problems, because people aren't connecting. So thank you guys so much for making time for this today and what you guys are doing and the impact that you're having. This was awesome.
This was awesome. Thanks, Jesse.
All right. See you guys.